In case you missed this, Donald Trump gave a speech in Pennsylvania the other night, and he offered a beautiful ode to the Battle of Gettysburg.
Gettysburg, what an unbelievable battle that was, the Battle of Gettysburg. What an unbelievable, I mean, it was so much and so interesting and so vicious and horrible and so beautiful in so many different ways. It represented such a big portion of the success of this country. Gettysburg, wow.
That guy was our president. That guy. My name is Jeff Perlman. I'm the New York Times bestselling author of 10 books and the host of Two Writers Slinging the Yang, the podcast where one writer, me, talks writing with another writer every single week. And today's guest is Amy Gutierrez, the Emmy-winning producer, reporter, San Francisco Giants in-game host, and author of a beautiful new children's book, Smarty Marty Takes the Field. This is episode number 359. Let's sling some yang.
Dad, your podcast sucks and you smell like Jack Sigma's armpit.
Okay, Amy, first of all, I just want to say, considering your husband back in my Sports Illustrated days was my heated arch rival and has become a really good friend, the unlikeliness that not only would I have Paul Gutierrez on this podcast, but then his wife. I mean, if you told me this in 1995,
you guys have really matured. I'm proud of you.
You married well, as did he, I'm sure. So
I agree. He did.
All right. So you're the author of Smarty Marty Takes the Field. It's your third children's book in the Smarty Marty series. And usually on this podcast, I have sports writers, authors who write these long books, and I haven't done a ton of children's books. I just haven't. To me, it seems actually really intimidating. The brevity of a children's book, the use of language in a children's book at a certain level. But am I overthinking this?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I look at what you do and think that looks really, really hard to write, you know, that amount of information. So I guess it kind of depends on how your brain works, but it's not easy. I mean, the first publication, Smarty Marty's Got Game, which came out in 2013, I wrote way more than I should have. But you know, you go through the process and that's probably all the same for authors dealing with editors, and you're going to go through many, many drafts. And probably the most difficult part was figuring out where I wanted the relationship between Marty and her brother, which you also meet in the one that you just read, Smarty Marty Takes the Field. But the first book is a lot about this sibling relationship and utilizing baseball to bond. And you can bond by scoring baseball. That's the whole concept. And so there was an educational aspect. So the difficult part was kind of the brevity of it. Like, we needed a word count, and you also had to use language that was going to be understandable for an age group that was learning to read. That was probably my biggest challenge, was finding out that there weren't a lot of books in this category at this length and level for children. And that's why it all happened in the first place, was the boutique publisher, Cameron Kids, came to me and said, you know, we got kids that are just learning to read, like 5, 6, 7 to, you know, 8, 9. There's no information on baseball for them that's easy to consume, easy to understand, easy to read. We have like a baby book, Touch and Feel, to a Jeff Perlman book, right? Like, it was like there's this void. So that's how it came about. But back to your question, no, it is difficult because you have to think differently. And when you're a writer by nature, you want to expand. So that's the hard part, is getting a lot in with a little. And the key to children's books, Jeff, is the illustrator. So the illustrator tells so much of what you don't have time to write, or you can't write because you're on a word count. So the pictures become so much of the story.
Okay, wait, I have multiple questions here. The initial idea for Smarty Marty, the actual concept.
Yeah.
Which in base level is a girl who loves baseball.
Knows everything about baseball. Yep.
Is that something you think of one night and you're like, this should be a good book?
So no, I didn't think of it at all. I was kind of doing my gig. I felt I'd found finally a rhythm with the Giants. This was 2012. I'd started in 2008. Wasn't the easiest gig for the first 3 years, and I wasn't very well received. I had joined this all-star broadcast team with Dwayne Kuiper and Mike Kruko, and who was I, and why is she here, blah blah blah, right? Fast forward to 2010, they win. Winning is a wonderful deodorant and covers up a lot. And all of a sudden, my role started to change and started to get a little more accepted. So by 2012, I'm, you know, hitting my stride. And I'm approached by Cameron Kids about this idea. And it's probably September. So that was the only one of the three that the Giants actually clinched the division early enough that, you know, you knew what was ahead of you. And I had a meeting and they told me about this lack of children's books about baseball for this age group. And would I consider writing this? And it was super convenient because this publisher's right here, a mile away from my house. And I just laughed. I was like, I don't know how to write a show. I'm not an author. That's not what I do. And so my grandmother, who was my favorite person on the planet, and I write about her in Smarty Marty's Got Game. My whole author's note is about my grandmother. Huge baseball fan. Unfortunately, a Dodgers fan. I say that's her only flaw. It's fine. You know, RIP, Grandma. And she was on hospice. And I went after this meeting to go visit her. And I told her about this conversation and how crazy is this? You know, the Giants are going to go to the playoffs again. Who knows what's going to happen? We hadn't quite set this even year thing yet, but it was about to blow up. And she said, you have to do it. You have to write this book. Well, my grandmother's name is Martha. And so that's where Marty is. That's where it comes from. And I lost her in November 2012. And that's what came to me. I was like, I want to immortalize my grandma. I want the baseball world that I'm in to have a little piece of her at any time, because all my grandmother did was make you giggle and make you feel good about yourself. She was my biggest fan. And through all that time of difficult years covering the Giants, she had my back and would just tell me something fantastic about something I said on the air, or, you know, we talked a lot about the players. We talked a lot about the game. So that's the idea that sparked, okay, I can immortalize grandma. I can have a female empowerment aspect to this by having a heroine in a baseball book instead of a hero, a male hero. And I can maybe make her a little bit like how I feel, that I'm a girl who loves baseball and I'm passionate about baseball. And I constantly get questioned about that. So that's kind of how the character evolved. And the scoring aspect is straight from my life, from Smarty Marty's Got Game. I learned to score baseball watching my brother play. He's 4 years older than me. And I learned how to score the game at 4 years old, sitting next to my mom at every single Little League game. So I tried to just mix all of that together. And there's all kinds of Easter eggs in my first book about my family, from how I did the lineup to my relationship with my son is very much the relationship that you see with this brother and sister, because the brother doesn't like the game. He thinks it's boring. It's really long. And that is straight from my life with our son. And then I get to, you know, have a little piece of grandma with everybody out there.
Wait, some follow-ups here. Number one, did you consider making Marty a Dodger fan?
Not once has it ever crossed my mind.
Number two, does it hurt you as a baseball lifer and a person who is so passionate about the game that your son doesn't give a shit about baseball?
No, it doesn't at all. It's funny. Paul would answer. I think Paul always kind of hoped Zach would be like, hey, Dad, let's watch a game, you know? And I'm not really mocking that. I think that's a real thing. I find Zachary, who's now 19, and he is an unbelievable artist, one of the most fascinating people in my life, because he doesn't care about sports. And everyone else in our life, and you know, so much of my marriage revolves around sports. And Zach is like this shining light, you know, and he also makes Paul and I much broader people with what he's interested in. And so it's been wonderful. I mean, I tried to take him to a game. He was like six and he loved like the camera, you know, my camera guys were working the stationary cameras and he got to do that. He liked a lot of that stuff. But when it came to sitting down, watching the game, second inning, he was six. Did you bring my iPad, Mom?
Oh my God.
And I was like, oh, we're probably going to go home. It's just not his thing. But if he scored a game, because he would go for family functions or whatever, if he scored a game, he hung in there for six or seven innings. He found that fascinating. So that was kind of my hook in the first book, beyond telling a little bit and having some a cathartic experience for all the books that I've written have been very cathartic. But it also is like, hey, put your phone down, watch the game, have a conversation. I was seeing that take place in all the games that I was covering. You know, people were just in their phone.
Yeah.
And the other part, I'd walk around scoring the game and I had to go all over that park. I would log like 5,000 steps a game and people would say, you know how to score? You know, that was my favorite. You know how to score? And it was like, well, of course, this is my story. I have about 20 seconds once the game's over to grab whoever I'm going to grab for an interview and ask them three or four questions. I got to look down at my legend here. But also, it was like, well, how else would I know what's happening in the game? Like, I'm going from here to here and behind the stadium, and I can't hear everything with my IFB. So this is how I know what happened.
Does anyone know how to score baseball anymore? Anyone under the age of 40?
Yeah, I think there are. And baseball is generational. And so you see every generation at a game still, and you'll see, you know, grandma with her hat and all of her pins and her official scorebook. And that was always one of my funnest things when I did cover the games, was going up and chatting with somebody about how they scored a certain play. You know, what did you see there? It never has anybody said, don't look at my scorecard. I don't want you to see how I scored that. You know, it's a conversation starter. And I loved that part of baseball and that part of the game.
Does Paul Gutierrez know how to score a baseball game?
Very well.
Okay, just checking. Okay, you mentioned the illustrators are usually an important part of a book.
Huge.
Again, you reached this agreement to write this book, your first one more than a decade ago now. Do you pick an illustrator? Do you have any say on the illustrator? Do you even meet the illustrator? How does that work?
I was so new at this process, and I mean, completely green with the first book, that my publisher had an illustrator in mind. And he was local in Marin County, and he was a huge Giants fan. And so I did get to look at his illustrations, but I was like, that's great. I mean, I had no idea. So anything he drew was fantastic. And, you know, my second book, Smarty Marty Steps Up Her Game, is a chapter book. So much less with illustrations. So I'd never met that illustrator, and what they did though was very good. So your publisher knows, they have like a pool of illustrators that they can pick from. And so on this third installment, Smarty Mary Takes the Field, I'm back to a picture book, right? Where the illustrations are so important versus that chapter book where maybe we had a sketch to start each chapter. And they said, we've got a really good person in mind, and it's Anika Oryk. And I believe she's out of the East, back East now, but she grew up in the Bay Area. And they literally could not have matched up a better pair. I mean, she has her love of the game from her grandparents as well. And she grew up a huge Giants fan. There are Easter eggs all over that book for her family and for mine. Like, she was so cute. She's like, I went on Instagram and stalked you. And so our dog is in there. And if you really look at our family likeness, it, you know, Paul's a browner shade than I am. And the kids are kind of right in between. And there's the K&K broadcast booth is, you know, you can see little things like that. There's an Adios Pelota on somebody's shirt, which is John Miller's call. So even though we really were trying to move away from Giants centric, because the first book is Oracle Park, and the Giants granted me access and permission to be able to use that likeness in the book, this one is a more general feel of baseball with shout outs to the Giants, and obviously a huge shout out to Alyssa Nacken, you know, the first female MLB coach in the history of the game. So Anika, I got to talk to, and I'm going to meet actually next week. We're going on a little press tour together. But she was chosen for me by the publisher. And then I probably have some say in it, but I've never needed to say anything because they're so amazing. That what they do is, you know, it's, and my son, who's an artist, he has artwork in the book. So the wingers, the name on the jersey, my son designed that. That was the one thing I asked in the process of creating this book. I said, I'd like Zachary to be able to draw something for it. It can be small. I just want to publish him and have that experience with him. And Anika had to approve that. The illustrator had to allow that because the illustrations are her property. The content is mine. And she was great. She's like, let's do it. What has he got? And she was super open to it. So I loved that part.
The story reads really well. And it's like, has a real nice flow to it. And I just want to, real quick, like, it was the day of the big game, but this game was a little bigger than most because history would be made. It all began last Saturday. Smarty Marty knew everything about baseball, which was how she got her nickname. She was a meticulous scorekeeper and the town's play-by-play expert, calling Little League games all season. Calling and watching a lot of baseball gave Marty a bird's-eye view of the game. She saw things many managers couldn't because, well, they were busy coaching. Her brother Mikey played for manager Mac, a Little League legend. This did not stop Marty from offering some feedback. Hey, Skip, have you considered moving your pitcher up in the batting order, having him hit eighth instead of ninth? Skip, short for skipper, is a respectful term for the manager who, like a ship captain, leads a crew. And it's like really bouncy and really engaging. And it feels like no words wasted. And I am interested, when you are writing a kid's book for kids, what are you thinking as far as language and approach?
It's really interesting because, like, the word meticulous, you know, I labored over that. Is that too big of a word for the age group that this is targeted to? But what happens is, this is for me, I think every author has their own experience, children's book author or beyond. I think of parents reading this still at this age and the kids starting to learn some of this. So I wanted to use some language that a child would say, well, what does that mean? And then you can have that conversation as a parent with your children about what different words mean, learning vocabulary, learning what certain words in baseball mean, right? That's why I explained skipper or skip. And so I approach it very parental, if that makes any sense. And based on my experience in reading to my children, what they enjoyed about our engagement. And so that's kind of what I'm trying to do when I'm writing about a lot of education and time to explain, because it's a quick read. I mean, you were almost halfway through the book. Let's read. So you want that time with your children. One, you want them to love books. If, you know, that's what you hope. You hope that they love to read and you hope that reading brings them joy and it isn't difficult and laborious and, you know, because that's really hard for kids who struggle with reading. And so I wanted to come up with language that could cause a conversation, but also there would be enough easy language in there that they could start picking it up on their own. And what I hear most regarding feedback with the picture books is the kids start to memorize the story. So a lot of my colleagues in baseball have my first book and we all had children at the same time. So they were young and reading to them and they were like, I tried to skip a couple pages and my kid was like, no, you miss meticulous, you know, or whatever. So we all do that as parents because we're tired and we try and skip the story. So there's none of that going on. So I try and think about what's going to really keep them engaged. And that would be learning and the pictures and the story and engagement with mom and dad.
An interesting thought on meticulous. When I was a younger writer, I worked at the Nashville, Tennessee in my first job. And I would try to put in references that were sort of obscure or quirky. And half the time they get cut out because an editor would say, you don't want the reader to leave the page. You don't want them to leave the page. And I always thought, why is it wrong that they stop and look something up? Why is it wrong that they don't get the Emmanuel Lewis reference? You know, that they have to actually look. Like, I think that's kind of cool. And when I was reading that passage, even I swear to God, reading it, I thought, oh, meticulous. That's kind of interesting that she used the word meticulous because it's not a word every kid is going to know.
No.
Who gives a shit? Why is that so bad?
Well, and I really feel it's like a time reading to me is always about learning. And so I want to put some words in there that are a little more difficult for them to figure out and say, and then again, have that conversation. But I think too, like what you're talking about in your first job, you know, Paul's a lot like that too. Paul does so many, you know, trivia references. And I think you guys are similar in a lot of the knowledge that you carry and throw into your stories. And the producer side in me is telling Paul, like, this is long. Like, is somebody going to get this? But that's who he is. And that's what makes your writing special. And I think you, as an author, you're kind of trying to find your identity as an author. And so not having like studied writing and this was not my background, I'm still trying to figure out who I am as an author versus who I am as a journalist and a sports reporter and a mom and, you know, all these things. So I think it's really open to interpretation, and you should stick with what you enjoy, whatever your style is, then I think people will enjoy it. That's how I approached reporting. You know, again, back to, I was like thrown into this broadcast that had already been incredibly popular and well received with Kruk and Kipe. And I was with these two rock stars. What am I going to add? And I really had to get comfortable with reporting on things in the game that I saw that you didn't and that I thought were interesting. And that was going to be my path. And I had to blaze that path on my own. Was I in a position where I could break down the game? Sure, but why would I? I have Dwayne and Mike who played for years and are perfect with each other. So I can add more of a human aspect to this broadcast. And I can also hopefully bridge a little bit of a gap between the fan base and the players who don't see that human side or have demands of a player that are unreasonable. And oh my God, he can't get off the schneid. Well, did you know that his dad's dying from cancer? You know, like little things like that that help fill the whole story. And I think as journalists, that's what we're always trying to do anyway, is like, do you know the whole story here before you form your opinion about politics or the player or the team or whatever it is? And so my approach to this, I guess, is do you know the whole story about baseball? Do you know that, you know, you could maybe not be a fan, but have you tried scoring it? Trying that way. Have you looked at the nuances and the intricacies of this game, and not that it's 3.5 hours, but that whole families go together, and the experience of getting a hot dog with your dad or riding on his shoulders? Like, I have that in my memory at Oakland Coliseum, you know, being on top of my dad's shoulders, walking through a crowd to get to our seats, bringing Kool-Aid, like whatever it was. So that's my approach, I guess, if that makes sense.
Random. Who was your favorite player as a kid?
Dave Stewart and Will Clark are two.
I've had some moments with Will Clark.
I adore Will. He is, you know, I've met a lot of players in my time that I admired and then met them and I didn't admire them anymore, if that makes sense.
Of course. Of
But
course.
Will Clark over delivers.
Oh, that's good.
Literally one of the funniest, best human beings on the planet. And so good to our kids. And you talk about Zach and Paul, right? So Grace is our daughter. She's behind me here. And she loves sports, and she's a very good athlete. She's a great volleyball player, and she loves going to games. And she always has followed the Giants. She always knows what's going on. She loved Brandon Crawford. That was her favorite player. But when we go to the game, Zach was kind of like, are we going to go get a Ghirardelli Sunday anytime soon? Like, what are some of the other things we could do here? Well, we're in the dugout. Will Clark's there. Sean Dunstan's with us, and we're all chatting. And Will says, and Paul's with us. I think it was Mother's Day. Hey, you guys want to go down and hit in the cage? And Zach's like, nah, I'm good, you know. And Paul's like, ooh. Like his heart stopped because he was like, Will Clark was gonna teach our son how to hit, you know, and Zach had zero interest. And Paul was like, I would have gone down there and to hit with Will Clark. Like, and so that's the dichotomy of my family of, you know, Zach could care less. But and then Will took him down anyway and had a great time. He was wonderful with him. And yeah. So Will's the best. I don't know if your experiences with him have been the best, but
I told this story last night, actually. I swear to God, we had guests over and they were asking me about my career. When I was a very young writer at SI, like very young, one of my first baseball assignments was a Texas Rangers game, and Will was with the Rangers. He had broken his foot and he was out. A bunch of people were gathered around his locker asking questions. I just go, "Does it hurt?" He looks at my name tag. He does a deliberate name tag look and he goes, "Jeff, I
yeah.
broke my fucking foot." And I was like, "Oh my God!" And I just
Of
lost
course.
my play.
I am glad I didn't cover Will as a player. I think he would have destroyed me. And he says he was not pleasant. And he changed a lot after his son Trey was diagnosed with autism. And that's kind of Will's platform. And it brought a lot of patience to his life and perspective. And he'll say that himself. So I don't think I would want to cover him as a player.
You started with NBC Sports in 2004. You started doing reporting on the Giants in 2008. How'd you even enter the biz? Like, how'd you wind up at NBC? How'd that even happen?
False, how I ended up in the biz. So my background was in television news production, and I was a producer for, you know, 10 o'clock news, that kind of stuff. And then, and I was at Cron in San Francisco at that time was NBC, and it had just lost its affiliation and NBC was moving to San Jose, which is where it is now. So we all got laid off and Paul and I were getting married, and Paul was at the LA Times, and we really hadn't figured out who was going where. We were like, yeah, I mean, we love each other. Let's get married. We're fine. We'll figure it out. Well, the answer came when I got laid off. I was going to go to LA, and Paul's boss at the LA Times had just left and went to Fox Sports Net as and transitioned from newspaper to television, which was kind of the, you know, the beginning of the end of newspapers in general. And so I had an informational interview with Rick Jaffe, who was Paul's old boss at the LA Times, and got married, went on our honeymoon. And when we returned, I had a message on my answering machine, if anybody remembers what those are, saying that they wanted to offer me a job as a producer at Fox Sports Net to help out all the regions that we had across the country and help them produce their features, like a features producer. And so I started at Fox Sports Net on September 4th, 2001. And 1 week later, 9/11 happened. And so the job I really got hired for totally changed. Our whole staff, all of it, we lost advertisers. You know, Fox Sports Net at that time was really big. They had Best Damn Sports Show. Everybody was there. Kevin Frazier was there. And so we had this massive collapse, and I was basically kept on because I was a contractor and had no benefits. So I was affordable. And the job became like a glorified intern. I was running around getting video and doing highlights and all these things for our shows, but I was not producing stories, which is what I was supposed to do. Enter Fox Sports Net Bay Area, which was a region of Fox Sports Net. And I came up north and interviewed, and they hired me as a freelancer to start doing stories for, at the time it was the Pac-10, like halftime features that they needed to fill for their show. I was doing stuff for the Cal Basketball Report. I was doing features for the Giants, for the A's, all again, still behind the camera, and had really kind of decided that was going to be my path. I loved producing and I loved writing. And then I'm up here. I was going back and forth between LA and the Bay Area because my folks are in the Bay Area and that's where I'm from, Petaluma. And we lost a host to Roxy Bernstein, got hired to call games in Florida. I forget which team. And he was hosting the Cal Basketball Report. And there's two shows left and he couldn't finish them. And my boss said, do you want to host these? You write them. Do you want to host it? And I was like, all right. And we had just had Zachary. I was huge. I was like 30 pounds overweight. I was like, can I be a little bit of a diva? And can you shoot me from really high up so that the angle looks not so chunky? And I hosted the last two shows. Cause at that point as a contractor, you take any gig they offer. You're like, yeah, I'll do it. Sure. Great. You need me to wrap cable? 100%. I'll do whatever I need to do to pay the rent. And so I did it. And then he saw it and he's like, you should do more on camera. And that was kind of the, you know, the birth of going on camera. And people don't realize my background was in news. They don't realize I was a writer. They just know me from the Giants. And that didn't happen until I was in my early 30s. I think I was 34 when I moved over to the Giants side. A lot of people don't know. I also covered the A's for several seasons in a reporter role for their pregame show. And that is where the Giants saw my work. And Larry Bear said, bring her over to the Giants. And that was 2008.
Doing that job, do you have to give a shit whether the Giants win or lose? Or are you actually better served not caring?
Oh, I always cared. And that was always a discussion Paul and I had, because he felt I was probably too emotionally invested in the outcome of the game. And for the first few years, I was terrified if it was a bad loss or, you know, some like Buster Posey's injury in 2011. I was starting to get established at that point and feeling a little more confident, but my job, you know, I wasn't Paul. as a beat writer, you're uncovering things, you're looking for nuggets, you're breaking things. That's a lot of what your salary is based on, and your longevity in the game is in the industry is, can you continue to break news and keep the relationships? That's the key, is finding that balance. And that to me is horrific pressure. I just want people to like me. I don't ever want to have the confrontation and, you know, did you put this out here and not talk to me about it? Or who did you get this from? And who's your source? And having people trust you and trying to beat other people on stuff is not really my jam. And I was really an extension of the team. So it did matter to me. It still matters to me. I still feel it. Like if I have a feature that I have to do and go in and interview some Giants players after a tough game, for a while I felt like I was a little bit of a black widow. Like if I had set up an interview with Tim Lincecum in a week and then he gets hurt, you know, I'm like, it's my fault. I shouldn't have, you know, booked him or whatever it is, or I would feel cursed myself that whoever I was going to talk to, something happened to. And it definitely affected my life. And looking back with hindsight being 2020, I shouldn't have been as invested as I was. Paul was right to a degree on some of that. Like there was a better balance I should have found. And I certainly have that now, but I didn't at first. My whole day was affected by how the team performed.
Before we continue with Two Riders Slinging Yang, a quick word from our sponsor.
Hey, this is Casey Perlman, and I'm here with Anna Norris, my co-host on the hit KSDTU radio show,
We're So Crazy.
So, with the Screen Actors on strike, I landed us this pretty sweet gig doing an ad for my dad's podcast.
What the fuck's a podcast?
This thing old people watch.
Well, what's the ad for?
RoyalRetros.com. It's a throwback sports merchandise company that makes pretty sweet t-shirts, hats, and jerseys of old sports leagues.
Do we get paid?
In t-shirts. But he also says if we do a good job, we might advance to hats and jerseys.
And then what?
And then you wear a hat.
Hard pass. I'm going back to my side hustle slinging rocks on the streets of La Jolla.
I'm going to ask you a question you're not going to like, but I'm just going to ask it.
Oh, Paul told me you're going to have a few of those for me, so I'm ready for you.
You work for the Giants, and I wrote a biography of Barry Bonds years ago.
I know you did.
And I feel like Barry Bonds cast a real negative shadow over the Giants for a long period of time. Not just the PEDs, but his attitude, the way he treated people. Just a real dark figure who's also simultaneously kind of beloved by Giants fans, I think. And I wonder, how do you view all these years later the impact he had and maybe still has on that franchise?
I have a very different view of Barry. If I take my role with the Giants and all the time I've spent there and the time that I've gotten to know Barry and the amount of times I've interviewed Barry and take myself out of that and look at it, you know, as a fan base and watching what he did, I don't like what he represents in the sport. And even like going back to one of the features I was doing prior to being on camera, I was producing features for the Giants and I was pregnant with Zachary, my first, who's now 19. And I was doing a story on Barry Bonds' personal BP pitcher, John Yandel. He was a lefty. And so when the Giants would face a lefty in the NL West, they'd bring in Yandel to throw to Barry. And they took him on the road and all of this. They call him Cutter John. And so that was our feature. And he'd gone to Stanford and he was a pitcher. And I needed Barry for the piece. So I went down into the batting cages and I'm pregnant. And nobody has the nerve on the PR staff at that time to ask Barry if he'll do this interview with me. So I'm going down there by myself, waddling, and he finishes up and I'm like, hi, I'm Amy, and I'm scared to death, right? And I said, I'm doing this story on John. Do you have a minute to talk? And he goes, no, I'm tired. I'm tired. And he walks away and I'm holding my stomach. And I've told him this story. I'm like, I felt like saying, you're tired? Really? You're tired. Look at me waiting here for you. And at that point, he was being walked all the time. I'm like, tired from what? You know, jogging in and out from left field because you're not hitting because they're not throwing to you. So that was my initial reaction and interaction with Barry Bonds. And I didn't really like him. And then fast forward, retired Barry, who is able to look back on a lot of things, me getting older, and really as a mom trying to like kind of figure out your kid, it was not easy for Barry Bonds. And people can, you know, like this or not like this, or who cares? He acted the way he acted. Yes, he did. But when you get inside of his head, there is so much going on for that man. And he was in such demand, not a single moment of privacy in his career, none. And so he did things that, you know, made him look like an asshole, his big recliner chair, and he was by himself. But when you get to know him later, you know, his dad, very difficult, alcoholic. Yeah. Willie Mays is your godfather. Also, Willie can be very difficult, very demanding. And that's what he grew up with. And so then you really start to make a lot of sense of Barry. To me, I don't want to speak for him, but I think has a lot of insecurities that, you know, being retired and looking back, he can talk about now. And I interviewed him 2 years ago in front of a group. And I asked him, I said, you know, how would you compare yourself today to when you played? And he said, I'm a lot nicer. And he is. So I'm not really sure if I'm answering your question, except I'm very tender for him because I think people judge. And again, they don't have the whole story. Did he do a lot of things to make people not like him? Absolutely. Did he do them intentionally? Probably. But I think he also was very reactionary to stay away. I have no privacy. The only way I can get it is, you know, to be an asshole. And so that's what I'm going to do. And I really feel like a lot of it was more of a facade than who he really is. Take the steroids and all of that out of it, because it is what it is. You're going to believe what you're going to believe. But as a person and how he grew up and the pressures applied to him, I think really, really affected him. And so I'm very tender for him.
First of all, that was a great answer. Second of all, I ask you this, and I'm being sincere. In the Bay Area, with his legacy in baseball, would he be better served being like, look, it was a time period. Did I use stuff? Yeah, I used stuff. It was a time period, blah, blah, blah. Or would that kill his legacy and people would be like, oh, you fraud, fuck you?
Whatever the truth is, it is, right? And only he knows what that is, and maybe his trainer. I don't know. But I know what it looked like. I know how it came across. So if he did do that, I believe that the Bay Area fan base is the most forgiving fan base on the planet. I think the Bay Area is the most forgiving place. And so if he did do that, there would be some backlash, but I don't think much. And obviously he's okay not doing that too. So he's doing fine. He's in the Giants organization. I'm not sure if he's a special assistant or exactly what he's doing, but it would not be received poorly, in my opinion, should that be the case, if he were to do that.
Wait, so I'm fascinated by something else here. Your book, you have a special interview with Alyssa Nacken. Controversial take you probably don't agree with.
You don't know.
I feel like 99% of baseball fans don't even know that happened. And that's kind of a shame. When I saw her name and then read the back of your book, I literally had to Google it. And I saw the video and I was like, oh yeah, I think I heard about this. I feel like not enough people know about this. Because you're in the Bay Area, you're like, no.
I know. I mean, I don't know what you thought I would say to that, but I kind of think if you don't know about it and you work as a sports journalist, shame on you a little bit. Listen, as a female, to me, again, it's going to be personal and subjective how I see this story, but she is in the Hall of Fame and it was a really big deal. And Bay Area centric, but she's been all over the nation. And that news, have you heard of Jenny Kavanaugh? Well, Jeff, Jenny Kavanaugh is now the first primary female play-by-play announcer. She was hired.
Oh, I know about this. With Oakland, right? Yeah, with Oakland, right?
Okay. See, so, but to me, Alyssa's story is bigger than Jenny, and Jenny's all over the place. Now, Jenny's a dear friend of mine, so is Alyssa. But Alyssa was the first to crack that ceiling. And honestly, like the stuff she's had to put up with, it, you know, my stuff pales in comparison kind of when I was coming through and dealing with social media and, you know, all that time frame of 2008 to 2020. Alyssa's is off the chart. it's very difficult what she's been through, what's been said to her. And she is one of the most amazing, stoic, confident human beings. She's the right person to crack that ceiling. She can take it. And it hasn't been easy. But no, I think Alyssa's story is very big.
I think it's amazing. And then I went down the rabbit hole, but I just feel, and I was like, oh yeah, I remember when this happened. But I feel like it should be much closer to, I'm not saying it's Jackie Robinson, but it should be much closer to that turf and something that people are, someone that people are learning about in sort of a regular sense. And I don't think it's a name that rolls off the tongue nationally, but
maybe I agree with you, but I also think that that's just where we are with the women versus men in historic moments, you know, especially historic moments in sport, maybe very specific, because there's a lot of historic moments where women are known and make a name for themselves politically. But in sport, we're still, for lack of a better way to say it, you know, the redheaded stepchild of storylines. So it's too bad, because I do think she's had an impact, certainly on my daughter, you know, being able to see these roles that women are taking, but I think we're still chipping away at getting away from a quota hire versus you're qualified. So quota versus qualification, right? And that's the debate that Alyssa sparks. Was Alyssa the most qualified person for that job? And that's what people argue about. Should they have promoted a AAA manager up to the big league team to coach, and all the time that he had put in? And Alyssa's coming from, you know, Giants Enterprises, and she had been an intern, you know, so a lot of that gets dissected and picked apart. And you lose the bigger storyline in that it's going to take some quota hires to get us into qualified hires, because we can't get there unless we've had the experience, and you can't get the experience unless you've been given the opportunity. And it's a lot about going back to Smarty Marty. She says it in the book. How can I have experience managing you if I'm never given the opportunity to do it? And these are positions that, this isn't a physical contest, this is a mental contest. And of course we're equal in that sense, but it's still not seen that way because of the tradition of the sport. And that kind of crosses all sports, I think. But baseball in particular, it is a wonderful place to work. I work with amazing men, but it is a boys' club, and you can only go so far in conversations before you're counted out. So what Alyssa's doing, I believe she's qualified, but that's the constant debate, is was she a quota hire? Was this a marketing move for the team? You know, the Giants have always been known as being very progressive, but it takes things like this to happen before we get to a point where it's not questioned anymore and it's become the norm. And you're seeing, you know, what I did for so long, there's a reporter for every team now, and male or female, but a lot more women are working in the business. And there wasn't when I first started. There was a handful in the clubhouse, and now you walk in, it feels very much 50-50, at least in the Bay Area. And it takes time to build that up.
You feel like in your business, do you see progress in women not merely being sideline reporters, pregame reporters, but actually getting legit booth time? Do you see progress there, or is it still frustrating?
No, there's definitely progress, and it's definitely frustrating. I mean, no progress comes quickly enough for people ever, but you know, with the Jenny Kavanaugh hiring, you have Melanie Newman with the Orioles. We're starting to see the play-by-play role merge a little bit with genders. I still think there's room to help with the analysis side, which, so I now am on the River Cats broadcast, which is the Giants AAA affiliate, and I'm in as an analyst in the booth next to Steve Sachs, who's, you know, clearly qualified to be analyzing the game with all of his accolades. And I bring a different perspective. I think the way you kind of get around this, because I'm never going to have the opportunity that Steve Sachs had. I'm never going to have it. So it's utilizing skill sets, journalistic skill sets, the mental side that we can all offer and be on the same level, and opening up how we cover games and what information is offered. Because I still very much have that human interest side that I'm delivering when I'm analyzing. And what is a color analyst to people? And opening that up a little bit to expand how we cover games, because how do you become fans of these people if you don't know some of the backstory, know where they're from, and know, you know, that Ishmael Munguia, you know, wears bright yellow gloves because that was his brother's favorite color and he lost him in a motorcycle accident last year. And that's, you know, these little things that you're like, oh, I'm going to keep watching this guy now. Well, that's stuff that I want to bring as an analyst to the game. And is it taking it from the in-game reporter part? A little bit, but bringing it to the booth. And that will expand who can cover baseball, how we cover baseball will help diversify baseball.
I'm required to ask on this podcast. You may not have an answer. What's your best confrontation from your...
I knew that was coming.
Yeah, what do you got?
Paul goes, Jeff's going to ask you what player you didn't like.
I didn't ask that. I'm just saying, what's your best confrontation? But feel free.
I know. No, I never divulge that stuff regarding players. But I will tell you, the confrontation, I don't think I've ever really had a public confrontation. What happened was... when I first started back to, you know, 2008, it was my media colleagues that came after me, radio wise, about who I was and why I was there, and inviting the fan base to call in to the shows and have at me. And that was 2008, 2009, part of 2010 on the daily. I was a topic of discussion for what I said, what I did, what I looked like, how I sounded for sports radio. So I'll leave the letters out. People can figure it out. But all of those who did that to me are no longer there. So you just got to outlast them.
Does that still sort of burn you a little bit?
Of course. It doesn't burn me. It, at the time, it crushed me. And looking back, it just makes me sad, because the people I needed the most, right? Paul, my family, my parents, Crook and Kipe were amazing to me. And I had a very strong support staff at NBC. I expected the fans to give me backlash. A lot of that was hard. It still is. You never like to read something that somebody says about you, how much they hate you. I mean, that's never fun to read. But my media colleagues, that one was the biggest disappointment, because I just always felt like we kind of need to have each other's back no matter what. Like, come talk to me. You actually have the opportunity to get to know me. Fans, not always, right? They're going to just be from afar and think what they think. And I can't go individually to 40,000 fans a game and, you know, state my case that you should like me. But as my media colleague, you and I should chat before you go on and publicly rip me and say things about me and make accusations about me. There was accusations made about me and players. And, you know, that's hard on everyone, with your family and coming home to that and dealing with that. And then really kind of being told, don't say anything, don't have a confrontation, because you could end up worse and not have a job if you open your mouth, and you want to say a lot, but I never did.
Show me a woman in sports media and I'll find you a rumor that she, quote, slept with a player, slept with an owner, had her, like, it's just a guarantee. It's a guarantee,
you know, and it's really sad, because you work so hard at building the relationships and being trusted and being respected. And one person goes on and says something, you know, and the best story, this one's a public story, was when Jonathan Sanchez threw a no-hitter in 2009. And Jonathan Sanchez is like the nicest person on the planet. And that story's fantastic. If you're a sports nut, his story's one of the best. He's on the chopping block. Randy Johnson, slated to pitch that night, gets hurt. Jonathan's been demoted to the bullpen. They're talking about trading him. He's having a horrible season. And so he has to step in for this this kind of emergency start because Johnson's hurt and he's pissed. Like, he's like, all right, I'm going to show him. And he's on a 60 pitch leash and he just keeps going. No hit, no hit, no hit, no hit. And the coaches are talking. They're like, well, how long should we leave him in? We were only going to give him 60 pitches. Well, he still hasn't given up until he gives up a hit. He never did. And his father had just happened to fly in from Puerto Rico like that week to watch him. And he knew he was struggling and wanted to be there for him. So he's at the game, has never seen Jonathan pitch a major league game. And his dad's there and his son pitches a no-hitter. And basically his entire career flips on that game with the Giants. And he goes on to be, you know, a huge part of the rotation the rest of that season and into 2010, a huge part of why they won. Well, after he throws a no-hitter, he's going down the line. Hug, 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 right? 25 players, the entire training staff, the entire coaching staff. I'm waiting at the end with the camera and the microphone to interview him. And he gets to me and he goes, leans in. And so I'm like, all right, good job. I give him a hug, do my interview, get off. I call Paul and I've got to stay there late because I'm going to do some live hits for different news outlets. And Paul says, oh, honey, you got caught. And I said, what are you talking about? To caught? And he goes, yeah, they put you on camera hugging Jonathan. And I'm like, so? I mean, it did. I was like, so what? He goes, it's going to be bad. It's going to be really bad. This is a Friday night. And I go, you know what, Paul? You're just upset because I got to cover a no-hitter and you've never covered one. Right. This is on the phone. And so I'm thinking he doesn't have my back at all. He's jealous. Isn't that just not the case at all? Monday comes around, that radio station, they ripped me for a week on how unprofessional I was. And can you believe she hugged a player? This many years later, I'll hug anybody I want. I still stand by. I gave him a hug because that was kind of my reaction in general would have been that. Like, congratulations. I'm so happy for you. I'm so proud for you. I know what you've been going through. And look at what you just did. But also that this absoluteness of how unprofessional that looked at that time has very much changed over time. Now, the unprofessional side is a lot different. I mean, I look at things I did and I'm like, are we watching who's on air anymore? Are we seeing what they're wearing or not wearing at all? And, you know, things can get a lot worse, but they've also gotten a lot better. But that media outlet came after me for everything. So that I'm not burned. It makes me sad that they weren't better about it at that time. And we could have had a much better relationship and collaboration. And you should, when you're media partners, you know, you just should. That's what you do.
Final question. More likely to happen this year, the San Francisco Giants win the World Series or Will Clark comes out of retirement and hits 300 for the Giants?
Gosh, that's a great question. Cause I think Will would come out of retirement for sure. And he still hits at his home in Louisiana. I mean, he's got this great batting cage and it's the sweetest swing on the planet. But I don't know, the Giants are a little sneaky this year. I kind of like their chances and they've been bad enough that they're overlooked. And that's usually a pretty good position to be in any of the World Series that they've won. They were always the underdog. Nobody expected them to win. So I think they perform well under those circumstances. So we'll go that Will is not going to come out of retirement, but he'll be ready.
It's not like the Dodgers added anything this offseason. So
no, they're not at all.
Well, Amy, first of all, thank you so much for doing this. Second of all, Smarty Marty Takes the Field, an absolute joy. And I've had both good ears. I got to get your kids on the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I appreciate your time too.
I want to thank today's guest, Amy Gutierrez, for joining me on Two Riders Singing Yang. You can follow Amy on Twitter at Amy G Multimedia and buy Smarty Marty Takes a Field wherever books are sold. If you have a chance and enjoy Two Riders Singing Yang, please go to the vehicle of your choice and leave a nice review. I'd be really appreciative. Music is by the great MC White Owl. Thanks again for joining me. And remember, keep riding.